Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
How much of the intended winter wheat crop has been planted?
We have 84%.
84%. USDA meteorologist Brad Bippy says that's just a bit behind average, a little bit behind last year at this time, but in some states, planting is done.
Winter wheat planting complete by October 29th in Idaho and Nebraska, greater than 95% complete in Colorado, South Dakota, Washington, and Montana. It is good to see those numbers approaching or reaching completion in the north, where we did see significant snow.
So 84% of the national crop is planted, 64% has emerged. That takes us to the first report on condition. 47% of the crop rated good to excellent, 18% poor to very poor.
It's kind of a fair to middling crop as we start out, but it is very young in the season. A lot can happen between now and harvest.
This is Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
And we see soybean harvest progress reaching 85% complete by October 29th. That's 7 points ahead of the five-year average of 78%, just slightly behind last year's 87%.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
Now, we did see a lot of double-digit states in terms of the weekly harvest progress. That list includes several Midwestern states and a few Southern states, as once again, producers were racing for several days trying to harvest as many soybeans as they dry down in the field as possible. The double-digit increase list for the week includes Arkansas, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Missouri, North Dakota, Ohio, and Tennessee. Quite a list.
We move from soybeans now to the south and cotton harvesting condition ratings.
Now, the cotton harvest getting very close to the halfway mark by October 29th. 49% is the national number. That's 2 points ahead of the five-year average, but a little behind last year's 54%. Our final look at the cotton condition for the 2023 crop season, another disappointment this year, showing just 29% of the crop rated good to excellent in the last report, 42% very poor to poor, very small changes from last week's numbers, and very similar to what we saw a year ago at this time when just 30% of the crop was good to excellent and 45% was very poor to poor.
And what about the rice harvest?
The final rice harvest report of the season showing the harvest progress reaching 95% by October 29th, 1 point behind the five-year average, 2 points behind this time a year ago. Harvest progress has surpassed the 95% mark in five of the six production states. California, however, with the cool summer, is lagging a bit, just 75% harvested as we approach the end of October. Five-year average pace in California is 94%.
Rippey also looking at sugar beets.
Sugar beets. The good news is we saw harvest getting extremely close to completion in the Red River Valley and the adjacent areas that grow sugar beets in the north central United States. So before the snow hit, we saw the sugar beet harvest progress reach 100% in Minnesota, 99% in North Dakota, all but done, a bit ahead of schedule. And that has pushed the national number to 84% of the sugar beets harvested, five-year average 81%. Still, though, a little behind last year's 88% at this time. What's holding things back mostly is Michigan, and it's been kind of wet and cool in Michigan of late. That has slowed down, finishing up a lot of field work, not just sugar beets, but for other crops as well. That has left 32% of the crop harvested for sugar beets by October 29th in Michigan, way behind the five-year average of 57%.
Let's check in on sunflowers.
Sunflowers are going to have to wait a while in the north where we got some snow on a part of the crop. Nationally, 40% of the sunflowers harvested by October 29th, behind the five-year average of 44%, and considerably behind last year's 56%. Harvest is approaching three-quarters completion in Colorado and Kansas, but only a little over one-third finished in the Dakotas. And especially in North Dakota, where we do have snow on the ground now, 38% harvested, five-year average 47%. Hopefully we'll get a break in the weather as we move into November to get that number pushed along a little bit further.
And finally, peanuts.
Peanuts. We've seen some delays in the harvest where drought has affected the crop and led to hard ground and a tough time digging some of the crop. Nevertheless, we have passed the two-thirds mark to reach 69% of the peanuts harvested nationally by October 29th, just 1 point behind the five-year average, but quite a ways behind last year's 77%. The one state that really jumps out happens to be the number one production state, Georgia, 67% harvested on the 29th of October. That is behind the five-year average of 73%.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's a challenge.
Kyle Kunkler is Director of Government Affairs with the American Soybean Association in Washington, D.C.
Congress, they, you know, pass various laws in you know, that can require all sorts of regulatory requirements for a variety of different reasons. Perhaps it's, you know, environmental purposes, or, you know, it's, you know, wanting to minimize risks to human health or things of that sort. And it's up to the regulatory agencies to then take those laws and figure out ways to implement them. And a lot of the times that the way that those agencies, you know, seek to implement those laws can be, you know, fairly detrimental to, you know, to farming operations, and might be incompatible with how agriculture works. And so it's our job to work, you know, in government affairs, and especially those that work frequently with the regulatory agencies, to help them understand how agriculture works. Increasingly, far fewer Americans are participating in food production and are, you know, further removed from the farm. And they don't really have that firsthand perspective. So it's up to us who work in this regulatory policy space to help them cut through the clutter, to see and to understand how farming and agriculture works, what's going to work, what's not, and make sure that when they're implementing these laws, they do so in a way that's not going to harm our farmers and our food, feed, and fiber producers.
Also talks about helping EPA understand the reality on farms.
The spray drift buffers that EPA is requiring into this proposal could be significant. Maximum up to 500 feet for aerial application and up to 200 feet for ground sprays. There are ways you can reduce those, you know, again, by putting in place things like tree windbreaks and things like that, or using hooded sprayers, but, you know, not a lot of solutions that are very workable. And it could run the risk of farmers having to leave, you know, enormous swaths of their fields untreated, just to continue using herbicides moving forward. So, you know, you ask a question, what can we do to help EPA find a better way? Well, you know, part of one of the ways that EPA has reached these, you know, very unreasonable ideas is one, sort of not understanding where agricultural producers are coming from. So we're helping to instruct them and tell them what's going to be workable and what's not. But honestly, we think the EPA needs to just, you know, start from a position of trying to better understand, well, what are the actual risks of pesticides to species? And right now, they, you know, they make very, very conservative assumptions when they're trying to figure that out. They assume, for example, that if you look at a pesticide label, they look at that and say, well, how much are growers actually out there spraying? And they say, and look at that, whatever the label maximum rate is, that's what they assume. So in cases of like Roundup, for example, on soybeans, you could use up to 6 pounds per acre. But we know there's good data out there that shows that that's not what farmers are spraying. They're spraying, you know, a quarter of that, if that even. And that makes a big difference when you're trying to figure out, you know, what are your risks to wildlife? EPA also assumes that there is zero conservation going on right now. You know, they assume that no one is using reduced tillage, no one is using cover crops, no one is using any of these conservation practices that are going to have a protective effect on wildlife. So our answer to EPA right now is, one, not only do they need to do a better job of trying to figure out and understand agriculture and what's going to work and what's not, but they need to do a better job also of using good science and good data to even understand what the risks to species are. And I think that they're going to find the vast majority of species out there aren't at risk the way that they think they are. And for those that may truly be at risk, we can find some good common sense solutions to both protect the species and allow for farmers to continue to access these tools moving forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think members of this committee would probably agree with me that one of the major responsibilities, certainly not the only one, is for the USDA to work in concert with the Congress to advance the economic well-being of our rural areas. And certainly the key to that is the economic health and well-being of our farmers, ranchers, and producers.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
The reality is, in the last 2 years, we've experienced record levels of net cash income in farm income. But not all, or for that matter, many, have benefited from that record level of income. In fact, the ERS recently reported that nearly half of our farmers over the last several years have not made any money at all, and that roughly 40% of farmers have made money, but the majority of money they make actually comes from off-farm income. So that means that the top 10%, those who sell more than $1 million of product, have done quite well. And they should. because they're extraordinary farmers, ranchers, and producers. But I think we have to focus as well on the 90% that haven't fared as well. The president likes to talk about rebuilding the middle class from the bottom up and the middle out, and I think we have a classic opportunity here as we discuss the farm bill to do just that. I think we have two choices that confront us. We can either get big or get out, as Secretary Perdue once suggested, or we can build more new and better markets, providing entrepreneurial opportunities for that 90% so that they benefit beyond just simply selling livestock and crops and government payments. I think we have a new opportunity. As a result of resources that are available to the Department of Agriculture, we've worked very hard to expand value-added opportunities, to create an opportunity for our farmers to take full advantage of emerging ecosystem markets where they're paid for the environmental result that they can achieve on their farms, looking for ways in which they can convert agricultural waste into ingredients for bio-based products, like sustainable aviation fuel, working to establish a local and regional food system which complements our production agriculture system, and working, of course, to take full advantage of the opportunities to embrace renewable energy on the farm and to provide that to their community. Mr. Chairman, these are real opportunities for us to expand more new and better markets and to create an entrepreneurial surge in rural places.
But the Secretary also admits this is not a new issue.
Now, this is not a new issue and not a new challenge. In fact, in 1979, then Secretary Bob Berglund came to this committee and essentially talked about the same issue. And in fact, it goes all the way back to the beginning of this department. If you look at the first report of the Commissioner of Agriculture, at the time, a fellow by the name of Isaac Newton, not the real Isaac Newton, Commissioner Isaac Newton, in his preface to a 632-page report that he made to the President on the first year of the Department of Agriculture, he mentioned the concern about the consolidation of real estate in the hands of a few. So this is an issue we've been dealing with for quite some time. But I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful that as we work together to fashion a farm bill, that we indeed can create real opportunities for small and mid-sized farming operations. Because when they survive and when they thrive, it means that there are more people living in rural communities. With more people, we can keep those schools open. We can expand hospital and healthcare opportunities. We can create new opportunities and new customers for those small businesses that are so vital to a small community. So this is, I think, a significant and pivotal and transformational moment for this committee, and we look forward to working with you.
That's Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack. And this is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, I think we've actually stabilized a little bit now that we've got the new speaker in place.
Ranking member, Senate Ag Committee from Arkansas, Dr. John Bozeman.
The hope is that we can go forward and really start working on some of the problems that you've described. The debt, the deficit. In other words, we have a $33 trillion debt, but we're also running these $1 trillion-plus deficits every year, adding to the debt. And so spending really is something that we have to control. It's okay to borrow some money, but it gets to the point where it becomes unhealthy, and we're approaching that right now. So that's going to take everybody working together, and at some point we're going to need to tighten things up and go from there.
So how can they write this next farm bill?
If you go back to 2018, the farm bill scored at about $868 billion. That swelled into $1.5 trillion. Almost all of that's nutrition. And nutrition's important. But out of $1.5 trillion, surely we can get, a little bit of money to support our farm community. Right now, it's about $1.2 trillion for nutrition, $1.2 trillion for nutrition, and about $300 billion for anything that has to do with rural America and farmers. So, yeah, I think there's lots of rooms for us to shuffle things around a little bit without hurting any of the programs to make sure that our farmers are up to date. And you have a situation where the risk management tools, because of inflation, because it's a different world than it was a couple of years ago when this started, having the ability to have risk management tools that actually work for farmers. We've seen a huge reset in the labor market. Every business is operating differently now. Their expenses have gone up. Their insurance has gone up. We need to make sure that those kind of things regarding risk management are up to par right now, up to date, so that our farmers can carry on. The other thing is that this is important for the farm community, but what's important for the farm community is so important for the average American. We've seen what high food prices have done. You don't really realize it. When you look back over the last 2 years, I think the price of Halloween candy now is, and that's a little thing, but it's, the world now is full of little things. In the last 2 years, it's gone up 27%, 13 or 14% this last year, and then 13 or 14% the year before. But when you add all that up, like I say, you're in the 27% range. And that's the most popular holiday for kids outside of Christmas. So things like this, it's not just Halloween candy. It's everything that we eat, everything we consume. And it really is making a huge impact on Americans right now trying to feed their families. But what happens if because of the policies that we don't get done, contribute to another 27%? Where is the breaking point? So the decisions that we make are really critical, and we're working really hard to make sure that farmers have the ability to continue to give us the cheapest, safest food supply of any place in the nation. I think the average percent of what Americans pay for their food is like 12%, something like that. And don't hold me exactly, but the average throughout the world is about 25% of your income, your take-home pay. So this is, these are big things.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
No, it's definitely broken.
He's the Vice President of Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Ethan Lane, and says the process in Congress is broken.
I think there are rays of hope, right, in what we've seen. I think that you have a kind of a clash between the old system, which was very much rooted in loyalty to the party, because that's where the resources to get reelected came from. That's where, elevation to committee chairmanships came from. And so there was a party system in place that really demanded, rank and file members of Congress to stay in line to some degree. We've seen that system really kind of go by the wayside in the last 10 or 15 years, really since the beginning of the Tea Party, with the rise of some of these dark money groups that now can weigh into a campaign with more resources than the party can, typically with a different perspective than sort of the mainstream Republican perspective. Obviously, the Donald Trump era and that more populist bent has also added a new dimension. And I think it really has led to a destabilization of that kind of party system. Now that could be a good thing or a bad thing. You could make the argument, and I could probably sit here and make the argument for the benefits of either side. But it certainly, I think, is a cause for us to reflect on what it means for the party moving forward and how we navigate those things. I'm taking off my bipartisan lobbyist hat and putting on my Republican hat for a minute as a former operative. What that means for the party moving forward, how we navigate these issues, because we have some pretty big divisions in perspective, and they were on full display in the last few weeks.
But there are always a lot of distractions in Washington, D.C. How important is it to stay focused?
It's critically important that we continue to focus on those core items that the cattle industry needs to be successful. We are lucky in that regard, in that we are different than the rest of agriculture, particularly in a farm bill environment like we're in now. We don't have large farm safety net programs in the cattle industry that we need to protect. We do have risk management tools that are important, like LRP and pasture, rangeland, and forage. We do have important voluntary conservation programs we need to protect, that producers across the country rely on to continue being the most sustainable source of beef in the world here in the United States. But we do have a different sort of position there where we're not quite asking for as much money as other parts of agriculture. And so, you know, having that consistent message about the cost benefit of those areas where we do engage and educating members of Congress, both Republican and Democrat, about the need there. And quite frankly, the bang for the buck is sort of the baseline, right? Whether Republican or Democrat, the message is the same. You know, those dollars invested in you know, 750,000 cattle producers across the country, managing 600 million acres of land across the country, pays tremendous dividends for the environment. It pays tremendous dividends for, you know, the nutrition of people around the world, and it pays tremendous dividends for rural communities. That's an easy argument to make, and one that we make on a daily basis around here, you know, with varying success depending on the environment at the time. But that's the way you navigate that, is by not deviating from your message. You know, you don't retool because the tone has changed. You continue to educate and you make your case.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We're glad to see everybody here. I was hoping nobody would be here because we would have solved this problem. And we came this close last year. Literally this close.
Representative Mike Simpson is from Idaho at a Ag Labor Reform Roundtable in Boise, Idaho.
As was mentioned, we passed this bill twice in the House. Went over to the Senate, and I have to give a shout out to Senator Bennett of Colorado, who worked very hard. Changed it somewhat, added more A1 visas, that H2A visas, that a lot of people thought was necessary. In fact, a lot of people think that even more than that need to be necessary when we finally pass a bill. But he added more to it, and no one probably worked harder. Between the election, we knew they wouldn't take it up before the election because it was the election and it had to do with immigration. And we were hoping that between the election and when we got out, that they would either pass it or we could add it to the omnibus, as many things get added at the end of a legislative session to a bill. And no one worked harder on this than the people sitting around this table, but especially Nikki and Lindsay. From my staff. They were on the phone with me constantly. I couldn't get rid of them. I had to get rid of my phone to get rid of them. They were on the phone constantly making phone calls and stuff to staffers from various senators' offices and stuff. And we needed to get 10 Republicans to say, okay, because at that time we had 50 Republicans, 50 Democrats, and we needed 10 Republicans to go past the cloture vote. We got 10 Republicans, but it was just after Schumer closed it down and said, that's all we're going to do. Day before, we probably would have had this bill on the omnibus. And today we'd be talking about, okay, how did that work? What changes need to be made? Any bill that you pass is not perfect. And you will have to look at it in the future. And I told some of the senators I was talking to, you know, we got a farm bill coming up. We can also look at changes in just this if we think that it's necessary. But right now, we have to keep the Republican and Democrat coalition together. It has to be bipartisan if it is going to pass.
So now what?
Do we introduce the bill that was passed by the House twice that had Republican and Democrat support and then let our Judiciary Committee do whatever they're going to do with it? And then hopefully talk the Senate into introducing a bill that they can pass, that we can get to conference. And I say this most humbly. I think our Judiciary Committee would screw it up and try to make it too partisan, addressing concerns, maybe legitimate concerns, that Republicans have, and not looking at what Democrats' concerns are. That's my biggest concern right now, overall. But let them have their way with it and see what they do. See if they can pass something out of committee. That's one option. The other option is, do we take Bennett's bill that was the House bill modified with more H-2A visas and a couple things, which I supported his bill if that would have been able to pass. Do we introduce that and have the Senate introduce the same bill? Or do we try to address some of the concerns that some Republicans on the Judiciary Committee might have in introducing a bill? And I'm not sure we can do that and get a bill passed in a bipartisan way. So I think what we're going to end up with is probably reintroducing our bill and letting the Judiciary Committee have their way with it, see what they do.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says El Nino will be the predominant weather pattern this winter, meaning warm, dry conditions in the nation's northern tier and cloudy and wet in the southern half of the country. What might this look and feel like? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says an indication can be found in the last time El Nino was fully established in the winter season.
Going all the way back to 2018-19.
He adds there was a near nationwide wet pattern going into the spring of 2019.
We dipped to a record low drought coverage, just over 2% of the country in drought in the spring of 2019. And we also saw extensive flooding in all three of the major river basins, the Mississippi, the Ohio, and the Missouri.
One difference between this coming winter and the winter of 5 years ago, more drought area is noted going into the 2023-24 winter season. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.